Welcome to Bombshell, recording to you live from Commodore Perry's desk at the United States Naval Academy Museum. This is Aaron Simpson.
This is Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
This is Radha Iyengar.
And we want to send a very special thanks to Claude Berube, who's the director here and also a gentleman and a scholar, and has provided us with a variety of tasty beverages in addition to some things that we brought with us. Ladies, what are we drinking today?
Okay, well, we have an assortment, but...
All naval themed.
We are drinking... I have rum, a rum and shrub, which is a way that you used to make rum that had been salinated, basically had been dropped into the sea in order to hide it from customs inspectors. So it took on a salty taste. You added shrub to it to give it a slightly sweeter, more vinegary taste. And the one we're drinking today is a grapefruit allspice. We also have ginger beer to make dark and stormies.
That's what I'm drinking. That's delicious.
And I believe we also have a selection of scotch, because why not?
Scotchy, scotch. So we have Scapa, which I assume is a Scapa Flow reference, sticking on point. And we have a couple of others here. My well-known aversion to scotch aside, we'll drink other people's scotch, generally speaking.
I have no problem drinking other people's scotch. I mean, but which we have had donated to us from other fans of the podcast. We'll all drink from then in the future.
Exactly.
So donate our scotch. I think that's the takeaway here.
Well, we would...
Or other alcoholic beverages.
Rational Security has had people bringing them booze left and right these days. So I'm just saying, show your love, people.
We're good for that. So in pursuing our special naval theme, our guest today is Janine Davidson, and we're going to call her on the line right now.
Hello?
Hi, Janine. First of all, welcome to Janine Davidson, who is one of our favorite DC mavens. I'm not going to go into all the details of your bio at the moment because I will get to them a little bit in our questions. But we want to start with our usual bombshell questions for you. The first of which is best meal you've had while traveling. And I know you've traveled literally all around the world, so we're expecting something good here.
Oh, well, you might be disappointed. But, you know, the best meal I've ever had by traveling, I think it is about the experience, or something about it makes the food taste better, but I'm not sure. It was on my honeymoon, our honeymoon with Dave, and we were on this long, hot bike ride where I was about to give up, and he was getting impatient. And we found this total hole in the wall pub in Croatia and stopped in and had the absolute best brats and beer I have ever had in my entire life. Like, we still talk about it. Like, it must have been, we can't go back because we're afraid it won't be as good as we thought it
was. This is a theme here.
But it was fantastic.
Exhaustion food
while on travel. Mine was Oreos and Fanta, so I completely understand.
Yeah, there's something about it, you know, and the setting was beautiful. So, you know, yeah.
It's a pretty good meal while traveling. Okay, our next question. I know you're going to have trouble answering this one, but the book you have reread the most or have owned the longest?
Well, you know, I don't reread books very much. I'm not sure why.
You're busy, I think, is the answer to that question.
Well, the book that sticks in my mind, I think, is probably a nerdy answer, but because I love historical fiction so much, it was The Source by James Michener.
Oh.
Something about that book that just totally caught my attention.
It's hard to reread Michener, so that would have to be one you've owned the longest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is. That's the category. It's not you don't reread it a lot, but yeah, it's one of my favorites. It turned me on to historical fiction, I think. That's probably why it is.
Oh, outstanding. All right, so yeah. Next question. Is the fan club or fan community you've been part of at some point in your life?
Well, you know, I've heard you ask this question to people before, and I always thought, I'm not a fan club person. But then my nephew reminded me that I did go to a Star Trek convention once.
Oh, I think that totally counts.
That just more than counts. Were you dressed up at the time?
I think that kind of qualifies. I don't think I was a card-carrying member, but I'm not sure there was one.
Where did that take place?
Oh,
is it in San Diego?
This is embarrassing. No, it was in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s.
That's really going to rival Mira's Saved by the Bell answer, I think, for this category.
Wow.
it was before all the movies came out. And so we were serious Star Trek fans back then.
Well, that is not my star movie franchise of choice, but we think it's an excellent answer for this particular question. But you've had a pretty interesting career at the Pentagon. You started as a civil servant in the Special Operations Office. You were a DASD for plans early in the Obama administration. But your last job was as Undersecretary of the Navy, which I have to say is like just incredibly impressive to say out loud. I liked telling my parents this all the time, that Janine, you know, Janine is now this Undersecretary of the Navy. They would then ask me, what does the Undersecretary of the Navy do? And I will admit, I did not have a great answer for this. So if you could help our listeners understand, what do the service secretaries do?
Well, that's a good question. The service secretary, you know, I mean, we do have this thing called civilian control of the military. And we
all
like
who cares.
To, yeah, and all of us in Washington really focus on the Secretary of Defense and the policy pieces of this. But the rubber meets the road, it's services. And so the Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary of the Army, they are the president's representative, you know, in the services. So what does that mean? It's a fine civil military dance that you do. I mean, and it's a little different than the one in OSD, because the services are to organize, train, and equip. And so it's all about budgets, and it's all about policy, and, you know, as opposed to operations, right? So as the undersecretary is the COO kind of the Navy, and the secretary is like the CEO. So it was a fantastic job.
For sure. What are the kinds of issues? We've heard a lot about kind of readiness questions, and there's been a debate also about modernization. Can you kind of give us a sense about how we might think about some of the trade-offs? And in particular, you know, there's a new draft budget that's been released, and people are kind of digging through it, looking for clues for how the administration's going to address some of these things going forward. What are the things that you would keep an eye on the budget, or the kinds of trade-offs you weigh on the readiness and modernization questions?
Yeah, you know, this is like the hardest thing that I did when I was in that job, because, you know, now that I'm out, I have a hard time explaining to people outside of Washington, outside of the Pentagon, why $170 billion, which is the Navy Marine Corps combined budget, why that's not enough to put our ships on the water and our planes in the air. And what I learned is that I think that Americans are a little sticker shocked about what it takes to go to war. And I think that we, like a lot of businesses, focus on the sexy new modernization initiatives without often thinking about what it takes for plain old sustainment. And so in the Navy, for instance, the biggest challenge, I mean, it really was readiness, because you can't just, and it's this Rubik's Cube, you know, of a problem, because you can't just say, move money from here to there and buy more stuff and then not buy the next generation of weapon systems to put on the destroyers, for instance, but then not fund the readiness accounts. Because guess what? This is the complicated part. Not complicated once I explain it, but you have to put the ships into, you know, a maintenance period in order to put the weapons on the ship. Right? And so you actually can't get there from the way in which a lot of our processes work, and when you get Congress involved and they want to pay for X and not Y, and you have to, it's really hard to constantly be explaining that you actually have to pay for the ships that you have, and also, and this is important, pay for the people who are actually working on those ships. And I'm not talking about the sailors, I'm talking about the civilians that work in those shipyards and the civilians that work in the Pentagon that are so much maligned as, you know, bureaucrats, and it's just not true. So those are some of the, I think that is the number one trade-off issue set, which is how to continue to put your ships on the water and the planes in the air while at the same time trying to get to the next generation, after we have had, you know, 15 years of driving these ships so hard and these planes and not actually doing the maintenance on them that we were supposed to be doing. So every time we bring them in for maintenance, it takes longer than we think and they're more broken than we think. So anyway, those are the big issues that you need to watch for going forward. It doesn't work like that for my car, so it doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good point, Janine, because I think a lot of times there's a lot of lip service given to personnel policies and military families. But just the same way that we think about how to sustain our equipment, we also need sustainment investments in the personnel. And then we don't really have a good total force concept right now that includes the civilian components.
It's so important.
That really hurts morale there and, frankly, probably hurts our operational readiness.
Well, and that's same issue with contractors as well. And people always talk about, like, oh, we have too many contractors helping DOD. Like, well, they're the ones who are maintaining our ships. They're maintaining our ports. Like, it's absolutely vitally critical that we continue to fund them in a sustainable way. And yet, you know, every year in the budget arguments are always along with civilians. They're the evil bad guys that we need to get rid of without realizing that they're ones you actually have to you have to have them in order to do any of these things.
That's right. This image that we have of these, blood-sucking contractors is just not true. The image that we have of these lazy civilian bureaucrats is just not true. You know, we do not go to war. We don't. Without these people, and we can't keep treating them like they're second-class citizens.
Janine, related to that, I have a question, well, a two-part question. Since you're going back into the world of academia, what one thing would you change about our professional military education system to sort of better address civil relations? Or if you, going back into the civilian world of academia, if there's something that you could change about our current higher education system to give people a better sense of here's what the roles of the military versus civilians are in government or various institutions in the national security apparatus, is there a magic change you would like to make?
Well, I have ideas on this, of course.
Shocking. I know. I'm just totally shocked.
So, on the civilian side, it's harder to do, but it's very frustrating that H.R. McMaster puts it this way. You know, we have academics who feel like they have sort of conflated the study of war with advocacy of war. So these departments all over America, so few are still studying the nature of conflict and warfare. And so then we end up with a generation of decision makers in the Pentagon and the White House that are not well versed in deterrence theory, game theory, we're not teaching that anymore. And, you know, we're starting to get a couple more security studies programs popping up, but we need so many more of those because if you don't have them, you're going to continue to turn to the military if they're the only ones that are teaching this stuff in the war colleges, and they're only going to teach it, and they're going to teach it in their way. Right. And we need that desperately. And then on the military side, I've been on a campaign on this for like 10 years, which is the role you get to be a very senior officer without ever understanding the role of civilians.
We were just talking about this. Yeah,
it's like amazing.
Yeah, not just in the government, but also in the Pentagon. I dealt with it in OSD. People dealt with it in the field in Iraq, and it was even weirder in the Navy. And so I don't know what they're teaching.
It's hard. You know. Everything's weirder in the Navy.
That didn't need to be said.
But I mean, for a long time they were teaching, this doctrine that, the military's role is X and then the civilians will come in and win the peace. But it is completely ahistoric. When has that ever happened? When has the military not had to have to stay? Where do these civilian State Department people come from that know how to kickstart governments in the middle of a war zone? They don't exist. But we taught a generation of people.
There is no Santa Claus, I think was the title of those slides that you used to use.
Yes. And so I preached that many, many years. And then that translates into, like, why are there people wearing suits in the Pentagon? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a reason for that. So in the Navy, the last thing I'll say, in the Navy, I spent a lot of time, working on that with the senior admirals. And it came down to myself and the VCNO, where I said, look, I'm not a commander, but I am one of the Navy senior leaders. I'm not going to command your sailors. We're going to lead this organization together. You know, there are levers that I have that you don't have. There are people that I know that you don't know to, like, cut us out of the decision-making loops and try to think we're just going to sign off at the end doesn't do you very much good. So I think there needs to be a lot more conversations about how to bring the civilian leaders into the processes.
I think those are all great points. Well, we want to thank you for joining us here at Bombshell today. And I want to give you an extended thanks. some of you may know that you and I are old friends. I, in fact, remember the exact day in the summer of 2005 where we met at a Starbucks in Pentagon City. We were on our way to see an upstart Army Lieutenant Colonel over at the Pentagon. And in many ways, the rest is history. But I think a lot of folks probably think of D.C. as a place that's built on credentials and social climbing and getting the next best job. And in my experience, D.C. is a place of relationships. And you and obviously Dave as well have been one of the most important relationships that I've had in town. And you've done an amazing job mentoring more than one generation of national security scholars and practitioners. No, but you're that good. You're that good.
I mean, you were actually one of my first bosses in the Pentagon, to be fair.
So we are all very excited about your adventure as a university president in Denver. And we all hope to come skiing out of your house and see you guys all out there. But we're also, I have to say, enormously grateful for the incredible amount of work that you've done in D.C. and will continue to do. So thank you so very much, Janine.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Aaron. And it's been an amazing ride, and it ain't over yet for any of us.
So, not even close.
Thanks for having me on the show. And you guys are doing an awesome job. I've been listening to the podcast, and I think it's going to be one of the ways I stay in touch with my D.C. contingent when I'm out in lovely Colorado skiing and thinking of you.
We look forward to hearing from you. Take care.
Thanks, Janine.
Thanks, Janine.
Okay, bye.
Bye. All right. Next up is keeping up foreign relations. And we have a lot of foreign relations to keep up this week. We're going to cover the president's first overseas trip in the next segment. But we're going to start with, there's actually been quite a few elections around the world in the last couple of weeks. We won't dig into all of these, but we've been doing a lot of coverage of North Korea and the Korean Peninsula. There were South Korean elections a couple of weeks ago now, but the left of center party won for only the second time. And that will, we think, sort of present some additional complications to the security challenges there. The last time the left of center party was in power in South Korea, we had the Sunshine Policy, which had a lot more rapprochement with the North and was rather more accommodationist and less interested in some hard security issues. So we'll obviously be keeping an eye on that in South Korea. More recently, we've had Iranian elections. The current president, Rouhani, won. But not without some challenges. And that was sort of in the same context as this big speech that President Trump gave in Saudi Arabia and a broader maybe reassertion of the American alignment with the Sunni world as opposed to the Iranian-led Shia world in the Middle East. Radha, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what's notable about the Iranian election is twofold. One, there really was a proactive choice towards a sort of slow but moderate path in a certain direction.
What direction is that?
And that's what I was just going to say. But the second part is that direction is really a modernized but very interested in Iranian power projection government, right? And so this is not a government that's necessarily on its face hostile to the U.S. per se. And there are probably potential areas that we can work with them. And I think we saw that with the Iran deal, right? Where we can kind of make, this is a regime that wants to do business and wants to integrate. On the other hand, they're very interested in the sort of Iranian power projection and influence in the region. And to that extent, the U.S. alignment or realignment or engagements with places like Saudi Arabia, who they view as sort of their direct sort of polar rival in this region, especially with ongoing Shia-Sunni conflicts sort of continuing in Syria and Iraq. So I think this election is meaningful both for what we can expect out of where Iran might go in the future, but also how we ought to be thinking about how U.S. policy, sort of U.S. allies, places like NATO policy, and then sort of this broader Middle East strategy might shake out. And I think U.S. policy hasn't quite firmed up, for lack of a better term,
This is sort of a back to the future mode, right? I mean, this is the Obama administration, for a number of reasons, was more open to Iran, certainly did not reestablish formal relations. There were a lot of cutouts, but of a key piece of the Obama foreign policy initiative was the nuclear deal, right? Which the Trump administration has certified as still being sort of in
pursuit.
Good
Actively
standing,
pursued, yeah.
But was definitely, certainly Gulf Arab allies felt as if the Obama administration pursued a more, Tehran-centric approach than a Sunni-centric approach from the Gulf.
And they did. I mean, the Iran deal and allows this is sort of to participate in the global economy. It puts them back in the oil market and back in direct competition with the Sunni oil producers. And it allows them influence, both economic and political, in the region. And I think, you know, we did business with them because we thought it was more important to do that than to... The Obama administration did business with them because they thought it was more important to do that than to sort of pursue this pure containment antagonistic strategy. And that might be exactly what we have to do in places like Syria, but that's in really stark opposition to where we are right now in our conversations with allies like the Saudi Arabians, right? And it's just, we're going to have to figure out how to split that baby.
I mean, what's interesting is that this administration's rhetoric on Iran has been particularly harsh, always has been very harsh, both in the election and more recently during the president's trip.
And certainly McMaster and Mattis are known Iran hawks.
Exactly. Right. But on the other hand, they haven't really changed a lot in terms of policy. I mean, they've implemented some new sanctions on Iran that I think probably the Obama administration would have done too, related to ballistic missiles. But at the same time, as you said, they've still revalidated the Iran deal. They have talked about reviews to consider whether or not they want to continue it going forward. But they haven't made this giant muscle movement to show that we're going to discard this altogether, even though that is very much what the president promised when he was campaigning.
And certainly none of us are experts in the internal dynamics of the Iranian political system. But I was struck just kind of comparing the news coverage as we've watched a handful of elections in Europe and in Asia and obviously now Iran over the last 6 months. How much of the coverage of the Iranian elections felt like, if not quite normal, election coverage? It was talking about things in terms of will of the people and themes and grievances with regard to the economy, and has the deal with the Americans, you know, led to as much economic opening and growth as they had hoped. And whether there's a normalizing of relations is a very different conversation, but it seems like there's a normalizing of the discussion
political coverage.
Iran,
right. Yeah.
As opposed to sort of the whatever the opposite of the great Satan is, but that had dominated our understanding.
So I think in some ways the best sort of news on the Iranian election is that both the coverage and the outcome suggest a continued desire for some sort of external engagement.
Hmm. Right? And normalcy.
Quo. They want to be in the global system. They want to be a player. They want to be economically engaged. They want to export stuff. But they also want a seat at the table. Now, that has consequences because there are lots of people who we also need to do business with who don't want them to have a seat at the table. And I think that's kind of what we have to navigate through. But on the whole, I think we probably, in a national security sense, prefer this type of Iran to a more aggressive, internally closed off Iran that was seeking to sort of push back on Western influence.
And certainly one place where that's going to play out in the very near term is Syria, because I mean, Syria is sort of becoming the World War One, where all theories and all trends intersect in this particular set of events.
Yeah.
And so you can watch our proclivity or not for confronting Iran play out in Syria. There was an airstrike last week against Syrian regime elements near the Syrian, Jordanian, Iraqi border, sort of toward the south, that was done to protect potentially American advisors and some Syrian rebels that we have been working with for some time.
But it wasn't just a Syrian regime element. It was an Iranian-backed militia.
That's right.
Right. So I was just going to say the thing about
as always
Syria.
In Syria, it's more complicated than you first think.
And of course, Syria is really an existential. I said this in our conversation with Melissa Dalton, which is Syria is an existential crisis for Iran.
People have described the war in Syria as a proxy war at different times. My gut instinct, I mean, I worked sort of closely on these issues for several years, but it's been a while since I've really been in depth on the particular conflict dynamics, is that we've actually resisted making Syria a proxy war. We've done a lot to deconflict. We've worked with the Russians to avoid overlap. We have tried to have kind of figure out how we do the common counter ISIL campaign and really push off some of the other things that would make this a true proxy conflict. There may be an increased appetite for a proxy conflict here in the next months and year.
And I will say, I think your World War One analogy is really apt, especially as we've moved towards things like arming the Kurds, which we not done, because there's so many different complicated overlapping ties here for powers we need to work with. So how we feel about the Kurds and how the Turks feel about the Kurds are obviously very different. And how what things like arming and making more independent, aggressive, and autonomous Kurdish areas mean for places like northern Iraq, but also western Iran, because the Kurdish region spans that whole area, mm-hmm. is actually really meaningful in a way that matters to those countries a lot more than it matters to us.
I never think of the Kurdish issue vis-a-vis Iran.
Right. Right. But like, it goes all the way across there. And, of course it does. And they think of themselves that way, right? Because the Kurds, in some ways, Iran has a twofold difference with being both Shia and Persian. The Kurds are in some ways a uniting force across all of these countries,
right.
that nobody thinks of the Kurds as part of them. And I think that's interesting, but you saw internal factions in the Kurdish region of Iraq playing out on both the Iranian-Persian side and the Syrian Arab side. And so we don't have a good feel for what that looks like. What we do know is that the Turks don't like it.
They sure don't. Right?
A lot.
Do they like anything?
Like, I mean, they like
beating up American protesters, apparently.
Oh, fair.
Yeah.
But going back to the airstrike, what was fascinating to me about that is that the militia in question was basically warned off by the Russians and by the United States as well, like, stay away from this area. You guys know better than this. And they continued. The American commander on the ground did not have to get permission because it was basically a force protection issue to have them fired upon. So was this a total screw up? Was it a purposeful probe to see how far they could go? And how much are we going to see a force protection issue play out in all of these different incredibly complicated theaters throughout the Syria-ISIS conflict right now? I mean, because the one that you just laid out, Radha, that's an entirely separate mess than the one we just talked about.
And so, I mean, on the one hand, this is exactly why you elevate these questions to highest levels of civilian oversight and interagency debate, because they impinge on 18 different desks and 15 different policy areas. On the other hand, it's exactly why you delegate it down, because there's a force protection issue that has to be dealt with exactly in the moment. And I think we don't have a great way to thread that needle. The flip side of this is also interesting from the Iranian position, right? Or even the Russian position. It turns out proxies are a real pain in the ass.
They don't listen.
They don't listen.
Always. They're like toddlers in some ways.
They know
better.
But they, you know, it's figuring out what it's very difficult to, I don't have certainly any great insight into the Iranian or Russian questions about the regime control, but how you maintain control of proxies in very complex battle spaces is quite difficult. And if this was a rogue element, right, that suggests that there are some command and control challenges on the opposition side here that are
difficult. I mean, if you think about it, we have pretty good command and control, and we still struggle with issues on what to delegate, what to allow commanders on the ground to decide, and what to decide high up, and we have these debates on it. But now imagine if, in addition to those debates, you actually had to figure out whether the stuff you didn't delegate would actually get listened to.
Right.
Right? And I think that's the position the Iranians are in, and probably the Russians too.
Do we have any further commentary on the Turkish reaction to arming the Kurds? This was sort of long foretold. It's tied up in actually the Mike Flynn saga in many ways. But we have made a formal decision to use the Kurdish forces in Syria and to arm them directly and support them in taking Raqqa. The Kurds in Syria are related in kind to the PKK, a designated terrorist group in Turkey. And so the Turks are very unhappy about this. But other than that, I don't know that I have a great insight into.
I mean, I think that's
this
it,
has
right?
been the strategic dilemma for 6 months or 6 years, and we haven't.
We made the choice.
And it's a porous border, and we decided one way for a while, and now we've decided another way, and we got to see how it shakes out.
All right. Well, to be continued on that front. Let's move on to White House mayhem, which, as always, does not disappoint.
It is mayhemous.
It is. So we're not Lawfare or Rational Security, and we would love to direct you over there for all of your deep, burning questions on the Department of Justice and the FBI. We did, however, have one particular insight, or a couple, I would say, on this, the firing of James Comey, the replacement at the FBI, the Deputy Attorney General, and kind of how all of these things are. It turns out the Department of Justice does play a role in national security decisions, and Radha's had some experience with that.
So both the Department of Justice and the FBI have national security divisions, and those national security divisions do a lot of important things. So some of the things they help us with are finding and capturing terrorists. And they work with other parts of the government to do that. They also collect intelligence. There are intelligence and counterintelligence forces for domestic issues. And importantly, the people who run those national security divisions, and in particular the National Security Division at the FBI, report directly to the director of the FBI. Right? So that means that in addition to the criminal investigations that the FBI, in fact, the current acting director Andy McCabe, was in charge of their national security division and worked extensively on a number of the counterterrorism cases in which we find, capture, and try terrorists in the U.S. court system.
The ones we don't kill.
The ones we don't kill. The ones we capture, because we're good like that in rule of law. So given that, this, it really matters a lot, two things. One, having an FBI director who can credibly be in charge of national security investigations, wholly and completely separate from any issues with Russia and Russian investigation,
these
election
are,
tampering,
these
or criminal
separate
issues.
From counterintelligence investigations.
Correct.
These are full-on national security questions.
There's a story, I think it was on NPR last week, talking about not only the Russian investigation, but also counterterrorism ones. And these are things that James Comey will be briefed on, you know, once a week, twice a week, daily, in order to both keep him up to date, understand if there's any sensitivities involved, and give direction on a regular basis. So it's not as though he was a potted plant. He was an active part of this.
Right.
And his gap is going to be
very tall plant.
Very tall plant.
And keep in mind that the White House and other executive branch elements are not participating actively in ongoing investigations of this nature, right? So the FBI is really the lead here once it's turned over to be a terrorist, domestic terrorist investigation rather than a sort of international capture. And so the FBI director, in terms of qualifications and contents, needs to be a person with familiarity in both the legal and the law enforcement realm that really matters.
And of course, we're still waiting on a new nominee to be FBI director. This is likely to be a very politicized process.
There and are a number of people have pulled themselves out.
We've had names, people removing themselves from consideration. There are folks who say that it's actually totally inappropriate for the president to nominate anyone, given the circumstances under which Comey was dismissed. So that's very much a stay tuned situation. I want to take a step back. I mean, it's actually quite difficult as you're following the, I don't know, almost tactical news cycle on this piece, to zoom all the way back out and try to get a handle on. We have a new special prosecutor, a former FBI director, who's going to be looking at Russian involvement in the presidential elections and any potential cover-up from a criminal perspective, whether any crimes were committed. And that's going to play out, frankly, it could be for years, right? I mean, we honestly don't know. And
right.
You should go read Lawfare and our friends over there for some detailed diagnoses on that question. But there's also a political question, right? Was there subversion of the U.S. election? What does that mean for national security? What does that mean for the midterms in 2018? What does it mean for presidential elections in 2020? And that seems more rightly positioned somewhere on Capitol Hill and the intelligence committees and the judiciary committees. And it's less a question of whether any crime was committed, but what happened and what the political ramifications are. And these are, there are
right.
political questions that aren't necessarily a question of whether people committed a crime or not.
I just want to put a third bucket in there, which is the counterintelligence investigation
yes.
itself, separate from any criminal charges. Even if, let's take the best case scenario, the Trump campaign was completely unwitting and unaware of any Russian interference, but there was, as we believe based on public
right.
reporting, there was. What does that mean? What does that mean for access? What does that mean we should do in terms of cyber threats? What does that mean we should do in terms of sources and methods? And that is a set of investigations that, separate from any criminal charges, the FBI needs to, and I suspect is undertaking, right? And that needs to happen with the FBI, but probably in the broader intelligence community at this point.
There was an interview with Sally Yates in The New Yorker that came out.
God, I love her.
Today, I'm kind of obsessed. But at the same
time, I need to know her skincare regimen. She and Kushner can get together and just have a whole new skincare line.
They could launch a line, yeah.
Well, they're both out of, well, one's going to be out of work while the other is out of work. This is the opportunity. But in one of these interviews, not with Ryan Liza, but with Doug Blackman, he has this really just bring it home point that I'll quote poorly, that Russian espionage conspiracy has penetrated the White House and established leverage out of the National Security Advisor, the Vice President, and possibly the President. And this is an immeasurable humiliation to the United States prestige and gives us a lack of trust in any number of things. Like, as to Rada's point, you know, what information can we trust coming out of the National Security Establishment right now? Like, we have to assume in some way that the worst possible things have happened. In
yeah,
that.
We haven't even talked about this Lavrov meeting, which is like the gift that keeps
right.
on giving to the news cycle. There's 18 different storylines that come out of one meeting in the Oval Office.
Right. I mean, the most innocent possible interpretations, as Rada said, is that like they were completely unwitting, that this was, you know, not an intentional collaboration or collusion on their part. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that Russia is not having influence over our political system right now. And as we have all these crazy releases that come out at 5:30 p.m. from the New York Times, Washington Post, it's easy to lose sight of that. That if I was working in the National Security Council staff right now, if I was working in the Pentagon, I would be terrified, wondering, like, who is influencing my day-to-day work right now that I don't know about? Because I'm used to understanding how the political cycle impacts me. I'm used to understanding that adversaries are trying to shape my thinking. I'm not used to thinking that the president himself or the vice president or the national security advisor or anyone else is an adversary. And that's freaking terrifying.
It's absolutely terrifying. And I don't think, I mean, certainly we have no evidence to completely corroborate that. The Mike Flynn dramas are also sort of the gift that keeps on giving on the mayhem side of things. And we had some reporting last week that suggested that while he's certainly in the mix on his calls to Ambassador Kislyak and kind of the Russian connections, he was also an unregistered foreign agent for Turkey and certainly Turkish business interests, and may have delayed decisions with regard to arming the Kurds and invading Raqqa. Again, the three of us have no specific information on any of that. But even the idea that that has happened has affected our national security decision making. I mean, is just beyond the pale.
I think Clint Watts in his testimony kind of summarized it when, yeah, I just highly recommend people go back and listen to it. I learned a ton about the ways in which, witting or unwitting, there could be Russian influence in a number of different social media sites. But he summed it up with saying, look, my problem is, as I'm doing all this as a former Army officer, as a former FBI agent, I don't know if my commander in chief and my political establishment has my back. And I think that's a really scary place for sort of a lot of our apolitical actors in the intelligence and criminal justice settings to kind of feel, which is, absent, frankly, this political investigation that sort of restores faith in the president, the head of the executive branch, and the commander in chief sort of having the back of the people who are working for him. I think there's a lot of discomfort there. And I think that's really, in some ways, what we're looking to get out of the political side of the investigation is, even if it's all unwitting, even if it's everything, you know, does the president have our back? Can we really count on this administration when push comes to shove to make the hard decision?
Clint's got a new t-shirt that says "Dance like the Russians are watching," which I think summarizes that sentiment for a lot of folks. Obviously, the president is currently in the midst of a multi-day overseas trip. Lauren, you've written a lot about this. Everybody else in town has written quite a lot about this. Do we have anything we want to keep an eye on as this is taking place?
Yeah, in some ways, he chose both the easiest and the hardest places to start out first. Like, Israel and Saudi Arabia are just like rife with landmines he possibly could have landed in. But on the other hand, they really wanted him to have good trips there, and he has so far done halfway decently. His speech that he did in Saudi Arabia was, I would say, inoffensive, and actually pretty good in some spaces, certainly better than anticipated. The areas that I will look for are at the NATO summit and at G7.
Are kind of an order of magnitude more complex.
Yes,
significantly more complex. One-on-one.
But there's a huge number of possible bilats for him to have, both planned and unplanned. The question of, you know, what is the NATO commitment in Afghanistan, as well as there's been further discussion of what is it going to be a NATO commitment in Iraq. I mean, these are sensitive issues that, even if not formally on the agenda, there will be a lot of interest in. On top of which, you'll have a lot of allied questions to McMaster about intelligence sharing, as what the president thinks about our alliance commitments. And even if the president himself doesn't speak to these, you can bet that Tillerson, McMaster, and all the other aides will be, you know, brought into a corner and asked what the hell is going on right now. I would also look to these sessions. Frankly, they're boring as hell. NATO in the G7, I cannot imagine a more boring set of meetings to sit through back to back. Will the president be interested in, I don't want to say acting out, but like creating his own drama, creating his own big deal solutions in these sessions, because most of things will be negotiated ahead of time? They don't really suit his personality at all. So what are we going to see out of the art of the deal for a NATO and G7 version?
And Lauren, as a veteran of many of these trips and experiences, I have two really important questions for you, which is, one, how many glowing orbs have you put your hand on?
I have never put my hand on a glowing orb, whether it was the Eye of Sauron or anything else.
And two, do you travel with hair shots? Seriously, why does their hair look so good when they get off the
plane? Their hair looks Amazing. So I traveled, I traveled once, maybe twice that I can remember, where the former First Lady Michelle Obama was on the trip. And she did have stylists that joined who were immensely entertaining and amazing people. But even then, even with stylists on board, nobody looks that good after a 14-hour trip. What did they do?
Props to them.
Just amazing.
I don't even know. Like, that's a miracle.
They could join the skincare regime in their own hair care line.
I would agree with that. Well, that's a good transition to what's next. What are we keeping an eye on? There's been a draft budget release. I think we're all keeping an eye on budgets. I saw something today that's, you know, let's all clap back and say, you know, a budget is not an appropriation. I think that's Olivier Knox who had that, you know, for us. Lauren had some good cheerleading in response to that.
2, 4, 6, 8 BCA, not sequestrate.
Yeah, that's terrible.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, I tried these jokes on my husband. He was not amused.
Well,
I'm just saying.
So the budget should actually be released formally by the time this podcast comes out. It's supposed to come out on Tuesday. The things I'm most interested in is, like, what are the actual details of the defense budget? $54 billion, even though it's supposed to be the hugest increase ever, is probably only going to buy one more ship and not many more aircraft than previously panned by the Obama administration. The huge cuts that we see to state and aid, we'll be looking to see how those actually play out. And the rumor right now is that they are swapping a lot of the foreign military financing grants, which is how we help allies and partners buy U.S. military equipment overseas. They'll change those from grants to loans, which tells me that basically nobody's going to use them.
Who's are they going to? I mean, begs the question of, if they're not going to take our loans to buy our gear, what gear are they going to buy instead?
Oh, well, they will probably buy Chinese, Russian, French. I mean, there's lots of options. Right. And frankly, most of them don't have as many strings tied to them as ours do. And now, the benefit of U.S. programs is that they teach them sustainment. There's training that comes with it. There's long-term partnerships that come with it, as well as interoperability. Those are attractive things for allies to have. But most of them tend
To value. They're attractive for us to have.
They're attractive for us to have, but to some degree for allies as well.
Sure.
But if we have a hard enough time selling them on our crappy-ass process to be able to get through this. This is actually one of the reasons why the Saudi trip followed by the Israel trip would be fascinating to see in the long term, because I have to imagine the Israelis are going to be seriously pissed off about the qualitative military edge issue with giving the Saudis $110 billion foreign arms, or rather arms sale of United States equipment. But that's a longer term issue.
So I too am interested in the budget with slightly different focus. So I've talked in the past, and I won't repeat the 8,000 questions I have on the personnel budget, and I look forward to seeing some of the details. But I think the point I will be interested in seeing is what the actual social spending cuts look like. So it looks like they're not going to touch Medicare or Social Security, with the exception of Social Security, SSI, and disability insurance. There'll also be big cuts to a number of the social support programs like WIC, SNAP. There obviously is the healthcare bill. And most people don't know that these have a lot of implications for service members. So I did a little looking up this morning before this podcast. It turns out that about 23,000 active duty service members use SNAP. About 1 in 4 children in DOD schools are eligible for free meals.
Which is already kind of a, oh my,
it's
seriously,
a whole
what?
Separate situation.
Right, like that right. Seems, you know. That's...
Transitioning vets, lots of them are not eligible for health care and VA benefits or full VA benefits, only combat related ones. That's about 1.2 million out of the total vet population. 87% of those that are currently uninsured, so that's about over 1 million veterans, could be covered by Medicaid expansion, which is rolled back in this budget. So there are actually a lot of consequences for the sustainment and readiness of the force that come through our personnel management policies. And it turns out, if you are going to be too poor, if your family can't eat, if you don't think you're going to be insured afterwards, a lot of people don't want to join or stay in the military. And that's actually a problem when it conflicts directly with higher force numbers and assumptions on higher retention, which a lot of the sort of force structure planning is built on right now.
I mean, this all gets back to sort of your strategy is your budget, and we don't know what the strategy is. We don't know what the long-term force management plan, what the long-term sustainment plan, going back to Janine's comments about readiness and modernization. We have budget hawks and military hawks at, you know, figuratively at war, you know, in this budget. And that said, this is the administration's first salvo. The horse trading that's going to go on in Congress is going to be interesting. That's also then circles back to the literal White House mayhem that's come out in the last 2 weeks. I mean, there was, the Senate was involved in markup and active deliberations on the health care bill, which came apparently to a screeching halt once James Comey was fired and the rest of these revelations, you know, came out in the newspapers. So this is a, on the one hand, you want the government to walk and chew gum at the same time. On the other hand, there's a lot of gum that has to be chewed, apparently, at the moment. And it's getting really
difficult. Sean Spicer swallows gum. So this is all for full circle right now.
Stays in your stomach for 7 years.
Oh,
right?
My God. That's I can't even. I'm kind of keeping my eye on Syria. I mean, on these escalation dynamics, on whether the Iranians or the Russians can get a hold on some of these militias, on what our continued delegation of authorities to ground commanders mean in terms of our posture and response in these circumstances, and whether we're looking forward to creating or pursuing a proxy war with Iran, in the terrain of Syria. There certainly, I think, are folks in the administration who would like to do that. And I think that it's more than a flashpoint. I mean, it's been a flashpoint for 5 years at this point, but it's a real, lot of small level micro trends can really build up into large scale policy processes in a world where we still don't have undersecretaries of defense. We don't have undersecretaries of state. We have very few people that can actually manage an actual crisis, at least one that's not generated by the White House itself. So,
I have to say, I would keep my eye on Syria too, but honestly, when I do that and when I prepare for this podcast, I get so depressed. So mostly what I do is keep my eye on cute pictures of animals.
Yeah,
good plan. Turns out that's just, you know, one in three things I look at are that, baby animals.
Moving on to pop culture, where I have to say that I was shocked to learn that my mother concluded that the best name for the pop culture segment was Bomb Pop, which of course was my suggestion, which she didn't know.
Shocked.
Whoa. And just continues along the trend of me turning into my mother, which is always a lovely reminder, you know, on a Monday morning. But we have for the continuing or to round out our Navy theme, we have a number of Navy pop culture references. One of the folks who follows us on Twitter reminded me of the fabulous movie No Way Out with a very young Kevin Costner, set in both Annapolis and Washington, D.C., an excellent spy thriller with Gene Hackman and a very attractive Sean Young. There's a lot going on in that one. But the Navy actually works pretty well for the movies. I mean, you know, Top Gun aside, or perhaps for Prime of Place, however you...
Officer and a gentleman.
Few good men.
It's the white uniforms.
Few good men.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the deal. The white uniforms are great on screen and kind of terrible in person.
That's right. Absolutely.
Terrible.
Like the shoes, they're disgusting.
It's so bad. I mean, and the Navy
also
really needs
really
to do
depends
some work.
On who's wearing it. Let's be honest.
The Navy needs to do some work on the ladies' uniforms. Navy lady uniforms are pretty bad.
There was maybe a year and a half period where they looked like Star Trek uniforms. They got rid of those very quickly, but they looked amazing.
My favorite was Admiral Mullen when he used to wear the khaki uniform.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
Which was like
he would wear them when he traveled.
Kind of really.
He just like he blended into his uniform in
and
a way
the desk
that was
and
terrifying.
Around,
but also still looked like a third world dictator somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very interesting.
Admiral Mullen, please come on the podcast. We love you.
That would be fantastic. So do we have other Navy pop culture?
What? The couch?
Throw out. Oh, we did.
Oh,
we
God.
Saw. So as part of our tour of the amazing facility here at the United States Naval Academy Museum, we saw the couch that Jack Ryan sits in Patriot Games.
That's right.
When he's in Samuel Jackson's office, which is probably the last time Samuel Jackson plays a character other than Samuel Jackson.
That's right.
It's true. It's
I
last
think
time
after that,
he acted
he just
in
was
any
done.
Way.
He's like, what?
I got
there
it.
There are snakes on a plane.
So that's a good... It's always important to remember that Jack Ryan's a Naval Academy professor.
I might have to go back to, like, if we were doing our original interview again, I might reference this museum as my favorite museum because this place is amazing. This exhibit will be here for another month and a couple of weeks, so please come up and see it in the lovely town of Annapolis.
Always good for a summer field trip. It could be your favorite museum or your favorite geek field trip when you're a guest on Bombshell.
Bring your own grog.
Excellent. All right, ladies. For Bombshell, thank you very much. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Bye.
Bye.